I have given you details of that cipher, and I would ask that you use that cipher when you're responding in any questions. Just a few things, A4. Firstly, as I've already said to you, please don't hesitate if you need a break at any time for whatever reason. I know that some of the evidence you will be giving you might find distressing and upsetting, so we fully recognise and appreciate that. Secondly, this isn't a test of memory. You shouldn't hesitate to tell the inquiry if you can't remember them.
I was always to serve in the church for the Eucharist. The church was a weekday church, so it didn't have a Sunday congregation at all. It was closed at weekends, or certainly on a Sunday, because F15 was in Cambridge during the weekends mostly.
And when you visited his flat, what used to happen in terms of his social relationship with you?
He used to talk a lot about psychical stuff. He was a member of, I can't remember exactly what it was called, Christian Psychical Research Institution or something. He was a leading light in that. So when I was about 14, 15, he used to kind of excite me, I suppose, with talk about ghosts and death and afterlife and all of those sorts of things, which I knew were off limits as far as my family were concerned. So,
and did he used to give you drinks, or did he used to talk to you in a particular way?
Yeah, he would give me drinks that my parents certainly didn't. I mean, my parents would give me wine with water, in a very kind of French way, but not spirits. And he would give me sherry and gin and tonic and stuff like that when I was 14. But he would never get me drunk. But I was always treated as a kind of special, don't tell your family. This is between us, you know, this is private. You mustn't share with your father that you're being given a gin and tonic. So there was a lot of conspiratorial behaviour. And he also used my adoption very heavily to confuse and disorientate. So he would kind of gradually work on a lot of confusion within me about the relationship between my parents and the relationship that I had with them.
Okay.
He was very clever. He was incredibly skillful, as I look back. Now an incredibly clever brain.
Thank you. So on the last occasion you visited his flat, I understand that F15 cooked you a meal.
Yeah.
And then after the meal, what did he do?
Well, he raped me. He forced me to strip. He kind of went very Jekyll and Hyde in his way of behaving, and forced me to strip and pinned me down on the bed and raped me and cuffed me round the head because he couldn't get it up.
Okay. So in the immediate aftermath of the abuse, did you tell anyone?
Not immediately, no. I think it took me a couple of years before I started telling people. It was around about 1978, and I first started telling people within the church, end of 77, 78.
Now, I understand that when and or publication of the name of any individual whose identity has been redacted or ciphered by the inquiry, and any information redacted as sensitive and irrelevant. May we now continue? So, thank you very much, A4. If we could just try and keep everything as vague as possible, so not mention any sort of places or names, that would
okay.
be really helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sorry.
So, no, that's absolutely fine. So the first person I wanted to ask you about was Bishop John Eastor, on the request of someone. And what response did you receive to your disclosure to him of your abuse by F15?
He claimed that he didn't know who F15 was. He got me to write the name down, and he got me to repeat the name, I think about three or four times, slowly, as my memory recalls. And I knew at the time that I was being lied to. I knew that it was extremely unlikely that a senior bishop in the Church of England didn't know F15, because I knew enough about the church to know that F15 was a significant figure. And then I remember him telling me, "You've done very well to tell me. This shows that you've come through it very, very well, and it'll be for your spiritual growth. The best thing for you to do is to leave it with me, and I will make very discreet inquiries." And that was it. That was the end of his involvement with that. I never heard from him again.
You also told a number of other individuals, which you identify and set out within this document, a large number of individuals, both clerics and other individuals who were involved with the church. I'd like to turn now to the 2000s when you... Ralph, would you mind getting up, please? ANG00502, page 4, please. The bottom of that page, if possible.
Yeah.
Now, you say that you disclosed this information to Bishop Tim Thornton, who was then the suffragan Bishop of Salisbury, and he's now the Bishop at Lambeth.
He was Bishop of Sherborne at the time, and it was 2003.
Right.
And he was somebody who knew my family, not terribly well, and I'm just checking that I don't say a name of a place. He knew me because he visited the place where I lived. We met six times or so, quite joshy kind of banter, you know, lots of humour. And then on the last occasion that we met, he asked me why I was living at that place that I'm not allowed to say.
No, the place you're not going to say, that's fine.
And so I told him about my... health condition. Is that okay to say that? Yeah.
Yes.
And he asked me why I thought I had that health condition. And so I explained to him and I told him my story. And it seems strange to... Is it okay if I just say a little bit more about that? Because I think this is an important thing, actually, for people to understand. I don't understand how it is that I can remember... in incredible detail, disclosures, but I know that I do. And I know that I've talked with others who've had that same dynamic. Some of these disclosures are almost as if yesterday, in my experience. They're so detailed. I couldn't tell you what I remember of a conversation with my mother at the same time, or with my neighbour a month ago. But the disclosures are incredibly finely detailed. It's extraordinary.
And did you receive any formal response or any action? Was any action taken?
No, none at all.
You also identify in 2003 that you also contacted Bishop Paul Butler, who was the Bishop of Durham, and I think at that time had just become the bishop with lead on safeguarding. What did you disclose to him, and what did he, and what response did he give?
The Bishop of Durham came and visited me in my hometown, and there were two witnesses present, and I basically told him my whole story. The local vicar had helped me had written to the Bishop of Durham on my behalf, and to be fair to Paul Butler, he was very quick in response. I think he was. I think he responded within less than 48 hours, and then he came to visit. I think 3 or 4 days. It was very soon after, and I disclosed my entire story and all the people I told and everything in quite a long, tearful disclosure. And at the time, I sort of naively, I thought mistakenly that I was the first survivor telling about bishop disclosure. I didn't at that stage realise that actually there were quite a few other folks who had told bishops. So I thought for me that felt like quite a big, scary step to be telling of that, you know, if that makes sense.
Now, I understand that you have written a number of letters that you sent to the church complaining about its management over the years of the disclosures that you made. I understand, in fact, you've written 17 letters in total. Have you ever received any, or did you ever receive any response to them?
I wrote many, many more than 17 letters. 17 letters, the number 17 is the...
17 the letters to Lambeth Palace, is what you say in your witness
statement. I wrote
statement.
Many, many more than 17. But I sent 17 letters to Archbishop Welby's office about the response from the Bishop of Durham and the then Bishop of Truro, Tim Thornton, as he was. Just the sort of blank and fog, as I call it, you know, fog and blank, tumbleweed, silence to really major questions and issues, cherry picking of one little question out of maybe five or six really important questions, and total blank to the questions about senior disclosures, and critically total blank to the issue of secondary abuse within the church. It was just ignored completely.
I mean, I understand that after you'd written a number of letters, you received a short reply from Andrew Nunn, who in fact we know about from previous hearings, who had identified and said to you that the Archbishop would be sure to hold you in his prayers when he hears you have written again.
That's right, yeah.
And you also spoke with Mr. Nunn on the telephone, asking why you had been blanked by everyone and why were issues of by a bishop being totally ignored.
And he told me that I just had to accept that that was the way we do it. That was the phrase. I wrote it down. You just have to accept that that's how we do it. And I then said, but for Christ's sake, man, I'm being blanked by everybody. And I was pinned down on a bed. And he then said, not immediately after, but about a minute later, he reminisced that he had gone to visit F-15 in the place where F-15 lived.
Yes.
And his comment was, I hope you don't mind my saying, but what a very strange image. And I thought, I'm on the end of the phone here to Lambeth Palace. What is this culture? I could not understand it. And David will know how stunned and angry I was by a lot of this antics. It was a circus.
So in 2014, you brought a claim for damages against the Church of England in respect of your abuse by F-15. What are your views on the way in which the Church approached your civil claim?
As I say, it was a rotten circus. The pastoral support was closed down. I rang up Cheryl Kent, who was the London DSA, and I think it's okay to say her name.
Yes, it is.
She was a hero. She was a really sterling DSA. And I remember ringing her up, and she told me, I'm so sorry, I can't respond. I am not allowed to engage with you. And I went, what? What are you talking about? I was completely closed down. Any kind of pastoral support, what little there was, I mean, the Bishop of Durham had responded sparingly, if that, really. And then I suppose I went on for... I don't know how long it was, about a year or 18 months from that, something like in that region. I'm not entirely sure how long the period of time was.
I think it was about a period of between about 12 and 18 months
something
before
like
the Church commissioned what we're going to call the Elliot Review.
That's right.
And how did you feel about the process in respect of insurers? You say in your witness statement that the insurance process made you feel profoundly re-abused.
Yeah, I mean, it's just toxic. I was called to Plantation Square, the BLM office, and I think I'm allowed to say this, it was 4 minutes walk from the Church of the Abuse. So it was literally around the corner in the very next street. And
I think that's fine on the basis that if we know, I know Plantation Square, and there's lots and lots of...
There's a lot of Wren
there's
churches.
A lot of things lost there. There's a lot of places you can walk in 4 minutes.
Yeah,
let's just put it that way.
You could... Wren churches are thrown out across the city like Smarties, you know. But it was four and a half minutes walk. The lawyer leading the settlement, I'm not entirely sure whether I'm allowed to say the name of the lawyer, am I not?
Yeah, that's fine.
I can say.
Yes.
Paula Jefferson, I met her very briefly with David Greenwood, and she explained to me that the church accepted liability for what had happened to me, accepted responsibility, and then they went off into another room together. And then everything that happened from there on in was everything to do why the church didn't, in fact, accept liability. So it was an incredibly schizophrenic kind of experience. I think the settlement process, or the horse trade, as I call it, started off at £5,000. Let me just say, I have a lifetime of mental health illness. I'm 60 next year. I am incomeless, and I have zero pension. I'm a bright person, but I have a very damaged past. They started at £5,000, and there was a kind of horse trade up, and the first legal defence used was he wasn't acting in his capacity as a priest. I'm going to say that again. He wasn't acting in his capacity as a priest. But I was a stone's throw from the church where I'd served for Mass every time I'd stayed with F15. The second legal defence was a wrong institution. This church is not owned by the church. You weren't raped in the church, therefore wrong institution. And so on. So it was just a circus. And then the final coup de grace, and I want you to hear this, people. The final coup de grace was when my solicitor came back in and said, Paula Jefferson has said that she's gone £5,000 over what she had initially decided at the onset of the day was going to be the ceiling, and your client should be grateful. That was what came across. I mean, I felt like a camel. I felt like a used car part. It was disgusting. And then, to my horror, I discover that the church house had core groups. Is it okay if I just go on?
Yes.
Is that okay? I don't want to upset your system, but
no, you're not upsetting any system.
The church house and the NST held two core groups into my case during the Elliott review without an invite to David Greenwood or myself. We didn't even know for 18 months. So the lawyer who had led the settlement about 3 or 4 weeks earlier was now sitting in a pastoral core group in church house. It was extraordinary. And then ecclesiastical claims that they had no involvement in the Elliott review. Well, they were sat there. Their representative was there with Ian Elliott in those two core groups. How can they claim not to have had involvement? And then in the mediations, do you know what those people did? They posted the letter from the bishops and their response, and 14 times they put my family surname up online for the world to see. And I'd never used my surname. I'd protected my family name. I've been very public as a campaigner and as a fighter for justice, but I'd never used my family surname. 14 times. And I think it was up for three days or something. It was a blogger of a well-known Christian, thinking Anglicans, who spotted it, and a whole raft of people had seen it, and my family name is very distinctive. 14 times. I mean, I have to say, that is pretty intimidating, isn't it?
So can I ask, because of the dissatisfaction that you had expressed on a number of occasions that you've told us about, the church decided to commission an independent review from Ian Elliott
yes.
in 2015, which examined the church's handling of your allegations. How did you contribute to this review?
The Elliott review was like an oasis of sanity between two kind of periods of weirdness. Ian was, from the moment I met Ian, and he worked with Jane Dodds, who was the former Church of England caseworker, and they just worked in such a good way. I remember Ian sat me down the very first meeting and said, I want you to know that on paper this will be called the Elliott Review, but the reality is that you're leading this review with me and with Jane, and without you this review is not possible.
Would you like a couple of minutes?
Can I? Is that okay?
Yes. Fine. Do you need a couple of minutes outside, or do you just need
a couple of minutes
to compose yourself?
Just stillness, yeah.
There's some tissues. Would you mind just, could somebody just pass us some tissues? Thank you.
And Ian Elliott was really the first person to help me understand, I think for the first time in my life, that I'd been abused not by two people, but by three people. I was still coming to terms, really, with all of that. I know that sounds strange, but I hadn't really fully grasped the depth to which I'd been disorientated by abuse through my early life, by three different figures. And the last of whom I think did, F14, did an immense amount of psychological damage, really more than can be understood. And I think I'm right in saying, David will confirm, that F14 didn't even occur in the settlement, I think. I think David's nodding. I think F14 was completely invisible, but that reflected the fact that F14 had been completely invisible in the response from the bishops, from Bishop of Durham, Archbishop Welby's office. So it was all of a piece, really.
What were your views as to the outcome of the Elliott Review and the recommendations that Mr. Elliott made?
I think initially the outcome looked really good. I think, if I'm honest, it didn't go far enough. And I suspect Ian Elliott, if he was saying, you know, doing it now, I think that he would probably go much further, because at that stage he hadn't really experienced aspects of the NST and Church House and the culture. But on the surface, I think it looked good. The involvement of survivors, drawing upon the wisdom of survivors, that was a very key element, I remember, at the time.
And shortly after the Elliott Review, Paul Butler, the Bishop of Durham, hand wrote you a letter. Ralph, would you mind if we get this up, please? ANG 000503, tab B4, Chair and Panel. This is a handwritten letter. It's on two pages.
Now, I think that Paul Butler was genuinely very apologetic. I think that he realised that he had responded very, very poorly to my situation, and had followed disastrous advice. I mean, he claimed that he had followed the advice, I'm not entirely sure whether from ecclesiastical or an agent.
This is on the second page, Ralph. Would you mind going to 002, please? And could you pull up the first half of the page, please? I am also extremely sorry, the passage that starts
lovely.
Yes, there we are. You should be able to see it. So this was Paul Butler writing to you saying, I'm also extremely sorry that when the solicitor's letter arrived regarding a claim, I did not overrule the legal and insurance advice I received regarding having no further contact with you. I should have made it clear that it would have been better to maintain contact.
Yeah.
I'm also deeply concerned that throughout this time you think I've been unconcerned or unaffected. I have thought of you often. I have wept for you and prayed for you regularly.
It's not good enough, counsel. You know, I mean, I wrote, I don't know how many letters repeating and repeating my abuse to people. I must have written 50 letters, I suspect. Certainly a dozen to Lambeth Palace. I don't know how many in total. David might have the figure, but it was a huge number. I wrote to figures within the National Safeguarding Team. It was very small at the time. Am I allowed to say their names?
Yes, you are.
So at the time, it was Heather Reed, Jackie Phillips, who I think was a sort of overarching manager, Simon Payne, who I think had come from Lincoln, and I can't remember the others, but there were about four or five. Do you know how many responses I got from the National Safeguarding Team? Zero. Nada. Zero response from the National Safeguarding Team. So I was repeating myself dozens of times and saying, why is nobody paying attention to the fact that I was abused by two senior clerics and other senior clerics walked away and are walking away still, and everybody just did tumbleweed. Silence from everywhere. It was staggering. And in the process, I effectively lost my jobs. I really went into very profound meltdown psychologically and emotionally. And I can remember for a period of that, I would be on the phone to Cheryl Kent, just howling. Cheryl Kent, bless her, broke her protocols. She broke her own employment contract and kept contact with me, because she, I think, realised that what was going on was so deeply immoral and wrong that she did not adhere to the whatever it was that she had been given instruction to. That woman had real goodness in her.
Can I ask now, following the Elliot Review, Bishop Sarah Mullally, who was then the Bishop of Crediton, who is now the Bishop of London, was asked to receive the review on behalf of the church and to implement its recommendations. What contact did you have with Bishop Sarah regarding the church's response to the review?
I remember that three of us, Phil Johnson and Joe Kind and myself, went to Exeter to meet with Bishop Mullally. They are now my colleagues, in fact, on MACSAS.
That's fine.
Is that okay? Sorry. Yes. I'm charting.
No, you're charting, and don't worry, if I give you a dirty squint, then you'll know that you've overstepped
okay,
those marks.
Yeah. We went to meet Bishop Mullally, and I think, I want to say here that, in fact, the request for a woman bishop came from me, so I was the person that felt that this needed a woman to come in and see things from a completely new perspective and shake it up. Because by that stage, I'd begun to realise through contact with others that I was not an isolated case in this blank and fog circus, as I call it, and that there were other people also having similar. And my instinct was, a woman needs to come in and just shake this old boys' network right up.
And did you feel that she did shake the old boys' network right up?
No. My impression of Bishop Mullally was that she was kindly, good intentions, but I think, sadly, she was very quickly hoovered up into the institution. And my sense was that she didn't really seem to want to grasp a lot of the issues. So she could only kind of contain things within boxes, if that makes sense, and didn't really want to look at the wider issues. And I I eventually got very, very frustrated. I think I wasn't alone with that.
Do you think it would have been possible for any one person to sort out what you describe as the mess of the loyalties to institutions and hierarchy?
I think that's a really good question. No, I don't. I would agree with where that question's going. My sense of it is that I don't think it's possible for any senior figure to lead change at the moment within this structure, because the structure is so riven with protection of hierarchy, protection of each other, protection of structure, protection of asset, protection of institution. They're all at sea. And I think what was really interesting, what we saw yesterday, for example, was a junior bishop or a suffragan bishop, not a senior figure, who presumably didn't have an awful lot of information some while ago, but has suddenly grasped how things have been happening.
I'm assuming you're talking about, just for the benefit, there was, he came on the radio for the religious programme yesterday, the Bishop of Burnley.
Bishop of Burnley, Philip North. Yeah. And my instinct is that it may well likely be bishops like that who are kind of up and coming, who will lead change. I don't think the current senior layer are able to lead change. I think they are prohibited from leading change. They're caught up with culture change, and they haven't recognised that culture change has to flow out of structure change. Culture change is meaningless. You could look at a potato for an hour and say, you know, turn yourself into chips. It's not going to happen until you get a breadboard out and a knife and make it structurally happen. And that's my feeling about culture change. It's got to come out of very, very profound surgery is required on this church. Really root and branch surgery, nothing less.
Now, as a result of the various concerns that were then raised after the Elliott Review, you entered into a mediation agreement between yourself and Paul Butler and Bishop Thornton, and Alan Wilson was also present at this. Ralph, would you mind getting up ANG 00503, page 13, please? That's the mediation agreement which was concluded between you all, which identified in particular that a letter would be drafted by the three bishops to the EIG asking for them to reopen the settlement and to discuss matters, and for you to have sight of that letter, and that they should also be engaged in communication with others about pastoral care for survivors, in effect. There are some other things, but by and large, could you go on to the next page, please?
Can I say
which
a little bit about
the substantive issues?
Can I say a little bit about how that mediation came about?
Yes,
is that okay?
I was going to ask you, how did that mediation come about?
It came about through my drive. I had to threaten both those bishops with week-long visits to their cities with 5,000 flyers in each city. This isn't currently public information. You're hearing this for the first time, but David, my solicitor, knows that, and Bishop Mullaly knows that. And I said, if you do not come to the table and apologise to me for what you put me through, I will come to your cities with 5,000 flyers, and I will speak in front of your respective cathedrals every day, and I'll take flyers around every cafe, every library, every church. And I'd actually booked myself into a lodge in Durham, in the first city that I was going to do. That's the effort that I had to take. And I want to say that because I think this is an example of the kind of drive that survivors are having to find in some situations to get proper response. And sadly, and it is with sadness that I say that Bishop Mullaly, Bishop Peter Hancock, Graham Tilby, the NST just sort of watched all of that and didn't really do anything. Okay. They just watched me do all of the driving. And that, for me, seems to symbolise so much of what we go through.
During the course of, as a result of this mediation agreement, a letter was written to the ERG, Ralph, ANG 000503, behind tab B5, Chair and Panel of your bundle, and the mediation agreement was behind tab B7. This was a letter which was fairly critical to the Chief Executive of the EIG, and on the second page, Ralph, are we having some problems here? ANG 000503003. So it should be the next page on from this document. There we are. Could I take you to the second page, please? Ralph, if you wouldn't mind getting up 004, which is the second page. And if you wouldn't mind highlighting from ANA4 downwards, just at the top of the page, if you wouldn't mind blowing that up slightly. So we can see, take some concerns, a settlement. The abuse has been lifelong. We're very concerned about the way that the claim is handled. In the light of these concerns, we believe that the EIG should take a fresh look at the settlement reached. I should just say, for the benefit of the EIG and the EIO, they responded to this letter and identified that significant degree of unhappiness and didn't agree with some of the factual material, which they've always said was not correct. So, in fact, the bishops did write and do what they said they would do in the context of the mediation agreement. You, however, were not happy with the reaction, in particular, of Bishop Paul Butler, and you issued a complaint under the clergy discipline measure. You referred a clergy discipline measure complaint against Bishop Butler. Can I ask, why did you make that complaint?
The CDM was before the mediation process. Okay. It was some while before.
It was before the mediation process. Why did you feel the need to issue a CDM?
I took out a CDM because his response was so thin. I was sort of barely there.
So this was before he wrote the handwritten letter to you and before the mediation agreement?
It was certainly before the mediation agreement, and I think it precipitated the handwritten letter, I think. Okay. I'm not entirely sure. But to be fair to Bishop Butler, he did do a 20-page report in the CDM, which he was under no obligation to do. But within it, he outlined that Paula Jefferson had apparently rung him to outline the legal defences that might or could be used, that she advised could be used. And according to this document, this 20-page report, the Bishop of Durham told her, no, I want the church to pay compensation without the use of legal defence. He was not happy, according to him then. So in the 20-page report and also in the mediation, which was witnessed by Phil Johnson and Bishop Alan Wilson, he very clearly told us that he was very unhappy with the way in which the settlement had been led, and he had clearly been given to understand that it was not going to be led that way. He has since sadly retracted his position on that and gone through somewhat of a 180-degree turn, and I can't answer the question as to why that is so.
I mean, just sort of to identify, what the EIO would say is that the reality is that if it's an insured claim, it's for them as an insurer to give instructions to the solicitor rather than
I think there's an element of that, yes. Yeah. Can I also say that one of the sticking points is that Ecclesiastical has said, they've said repeatedly and publicly and online, that in my case there was a misunderstanding, that the closure of pastoral support was a misunderstanding. Well, I want to put it on public records here and today that if so, I was present with David Greenwood at a MACSAS AGM about 3-4 weeks before the Elliott review, And we both heard from two other MAXAS members, including Phil Johnson, that the same thing was happening in two other dioceses. So, okay, let's be generous and say that it was a mistake, but let's also put it on public record that that mistake was being made elsewhere at the same time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your evidence. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Is it okay to just say a little bit? And I'll keep an eye on the time and I'll watch your nod, if that's okay. As I've said, I think it'll be the next generation of leaders that will lead. I don't see leadership in the current layer. There is a kind of vacuum of leadership at the top of the church at the moment. And I've seen bitterly and sadly how easy it is for a bishop to be given a golden mandate, you know, an incredible ticket for change with cherries on top, and not really seem to do very much with it. I don't think that this church can be rescued at the moment until there is really, really deep surgical reform at so many levels, until they start treating us justly and fairly and honestly. Let me say, I didn't expect to get rich, but I expected to be treated honestly and fairly and nobly and justly. And I think I had a right, and I think the people that I'm in touch with, many of whom have been re-abused by this structure, I think that they had a right to be treated justly and fairly. Let me say, on a structural level, I believe very strongly that mandatory reporting, as outlined by Mandate Now, has to be the bedrock, has to be the bedrock for the future. I believe that that's the requirement. And I also would echo very strongly the words of David Greenwood and Richard Scorer, that there has to be a very serious measure of independence within this structure, independent oversight. Can I end briefly on a personal note? I'm 60 next year. I was born in 1960. I'm incomeless. I've lost my jobs through this. I lost my home. I have zero pension. But at the moment, I'm currently doing the work of support, advocacy, campaigning. And I feel I'm doing it on behalf of the bishops behind me, in that room behind me. It's not acknowledged. And I know I'm not the only person doing that work of support for survivors, because there's a group of us who are considered to have expertise, you know. I face, as a result of reporting and having gone through this circus, there's no other word for it, it's an absolutely toxic circus. As a result of it, I face an incredibly precarious and uncertain future. And I wish in hindsight that I'd never reported when I did. I wish that I'd waited 10 years until you get your act together. I wish I'd waited. That's the God's truth. Thank you.